Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge.
We're just talking about how great the episode with Jamie was last week.
Jamie's wonderful. I like her a lot.
We have Alan and Joe here on the podcast this morning, and we want to talk about emotional sobriety and sex. And we've discussed on the podcast before, you know, I do this show with two therapists. A factoid that's come up a lot is that the hardest thing for couples to talk about in a romantic relationship are finances and sex. That was like an eye-opening statistic for me because, you know, I've found such to be true in my relationship. Whatever challenges I have, you know, in my romances and my sex, the emotional sobriety, such as it is, keeps me from falling in, getting too far out of balance with either positive, shall we say, like obsessive attachment to it, or like my negative self-esteem that's bound up in it. It helps keep some modicum of balance within this dynamic that can veer between extremes.
Let me elaborate on what you're saying a little bit more, Patrick, because it's an important issue to start talking about. I mean, how long have we been doing the podcast now?
4 years, about.
How many times have we talked about sex?
Very briefly or fleetingly, yeah.
We've never dedicated an episode to it.
Nope, never.
They did a study at one of the rehabs, one of those big rehabs, and they started to talk to patients about, you know, the subjects that were being addressed in the both in the group therapy sessions and in the educational sessions. And if you look at the curriculum that most treatment centers have, rarely do they include sex, either as a topic in terms of an issue that's discussed and explored in group, or an issue that's presented as part of an educational sessions. It's just avoided. And I think, see, you know, we've fallen into that same thing, is that we haven't had an episode in 4 years to talk about this. And so the issue becomes one of is, what is going on here? If we step back and say, how come we've avoided that? So what do you think is the answer, Patrick? This is important because, you know, get this right and you will get a new BMW Roadster.
There's a degree of shame I attach to being open or to it's a side of myself, and I think it's a side to a lot of us that we have feel a lot of understandable vulnerability about. And I think we're taught to just kind of keep it in the dark a lot of the time.
I look at sort of the evolution of the recovery movement from the time I started. And, you know, in the 70s, it got a little bit rigid for a while, you know, sort of like there were rules about no dating in your first year. Well, how does that apply to someone who's married, right? Do they have separate bedrooms for you? Like, it's just the stupidest thing. How do you learn about healthy relationships without being in one? And you hear people say, well, first you get a plant, and if you don't kill that, you get a pet, right? That's all just head talk, right? You know, people need to, you know, be in the real world, right? Like, we don't live in a recovery bubble, you know, afraid to go to a wedding with alcohol served or go out with work buddies on a Friday afternoon, or to the ball game or to on a date, right? You know, none of those things. I think we got stupid a little bit, and it was this sort of these firm rules, you know, all in the name of protecting people from vulnerable situations, which is not what life is about, right? Life is about living it, right? You know, we're trying to sort of, yeah. And in doing that, now let's also remember that I'm not saying it was better way back when, because in the 70s, you know, like AA is just people from the bar. They've got boundary issues, right? They've got sex itself is has an addictive quality to it, and it can be like, especially in sobriety, almost like a replacement addiction. Or people equate sex and substance use together, right? Like the idea of actually getting naked without being high, is a new concept for a lot of people, right? Maybe start with dancing, right? Try dancing sober. So I think that all of the that there isn't a set of rules that the way people should do it. People have to get out of their comfort zone a little bit. They've got to follow their gut. They've got to talk about it with their running mates, their guide, their therapist, whatever. Like, not my first ideas aren't always my best ideas. That's true years into sobriety, and it was certainly true when I was new. And the other thing is, it's yeah, we're not special. We're sober, right? The whole world doesn't have to, make way for us to free us from temptation. We have to get back in there and bloody our nose and learn how to do these things at our own pace, right? People don't have to rush into these things either. But it's got to be sort of a living, breathing, experimental, curious experience, as opposed to, following the rules. That's how I feel about it.
Well, you're making such a good point about these rules about no relationship for the first year. I've never heard anybody say it the way you did about, well, what do you do if you're married? You move in separate bedrooms. I mean, it does become absurd, right?
That's a
And
great point, Joe. Yeah.
and look, I'll get a plant or a dog. I mean, they're great, but they don't talk back to you. See, that's the problem. Is that a partner has feelings. Oh, dogs do. I mean, dogs, it's more. It's a very dynamic relationship with a dog. I mean, but it's a different deal. So you're right, Joe, is that some of these things that we prescribe or that were prescribed really are not well thought out, are they? They're just not well thought out. What I think is going on here.
They're all with good intention, aren't they? But
Well,
they aren't, they
yeah,
aren't
that's a good way to
holistic,
say it.
right? That's my,
No,
yeah.
they're not. They're not deeply thought out, is really is. I had an interesting experience, and maybe this might help us understand a little bit about what's going on here. So I met Dr. Kempler, my mentor, right? One of a lot of people attribute him to translating the principles of Gestalt therapy into relationally based Gestalt therapy, because he applied it to families and couples and relationships. And so I met him in a workshop in 1975, I believe it was. And I became very close to him over the years. And so in the early 80s, he said, I want to start grooming you to become one of the trainers in our institute. So he invited me to go spend a month with him in Europe, in Holland. He had a little home. A little farmhouse in Grava on about 5 acres of land. And so I go in September, it's early September. He cleared an acre of the land for the students that come to set up tents to stay on his property, and he did the workshops in his living room, right? It was really cool, man. It's big old, a house built in the 1600s that we lived in. I mean, it was really awesome. So I'm there. First weekend I'm there, about 40 students come from the University of Amsterdam. And mostly women, two guys, but mostly women. And they invite me to come out for lunch because I'm this novelty, right? This young guy from America. At that point, I was single. And so I'm sitting out there and I'm having a great lunch with them. And all of a sudden, it's sunny out. It's about 75 degrees. And in Holland, you get some warm weather. It's like, yeah, let's jump on it. All of a sudden, I'm sitting there and everybody's stripping down. The girls are sitting there in their bikini underwear, no tops on. The guys are running around in their and looks like little Speedos, right? In terms of the underwear they're wearing, and I'm sitting there, fully clothed, loving what I'm seeing. These beautiful Dutch women naked, with and I'm dying to just, gawk at them, and yet I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed. They're naked. I'm embarrassed. And I went to Walter and I said, "God, Walt, this is very interesting. What's going on here?" I said, "You got a nudist colony going on?" He says, "Good burger." He says, "You are now seeing the results of our immaturity in America. We're a very young nation and we haven't grown up much yet. We're still stuck with a lot of early ideas about sex and that are very adolescent-like." And he says, "We haven't grown. We're not mature in this area. We're still very much influenced by the Victorian era ideas of sex and that it's separate. You don't talk about it. It's a private thing, as you were saying, Patrick." And that hit me right between the eyes. It's something that I felt uncomfortable about because I really, it's something that just wasn't a part of my world. We never talked about it. And yet, I love sex. I loved being with a woman and making love to a woman and all of those things, but never talked to anyone about all of that that means. Especially as you get more and more attached to someone and they become important to you. The sex becomes an interesting environment for the relationship. This is the way Kempler said it, Joe. He says the door to the bedroom opens off the living room, the kind of relationship we have in general. And the way two people are connected in terms of their life in general is going to show up in terms of how they are with each other in the bedroom. If they're having trouble saying to each other what they want, they're going to have trouble in the bedroom talking about what they want. If they're going to have trouble letting go and allowing themselves to feel something and experience something in the bedroom, they're going to be constricted in terms of the possibilities of letting themselves feel pleasure or give pleasure. If they're more comfortable with just giving, then they're going to have trouble in the bedroom receiving. If they're more have more comfort receiving, they're going to have trouble giving. He says what the dynamic that shows up in your bedroom is what is going to parallel reflect how you are functioning in your life. I compartmentalized it. I thought it was such a separate thing, but how can it be, Joe? Right? We practice these principles in what?
Maybe the word affairs wasn't well chosen in all of our affairs.
That was good, man. That's right. That's maybe that wasn't what chosen. But let's talk about this. See, as a how comfortable are we talking about our sexuality? See, and the difference that men experience and women experience in our society, men have been given more of a green light to be sexual, but that doesn't mean we are. That doesn't mean that we're comfortable with. And because, I know for me, I brought a lot of my performance anxiety into the bedroom. I'll never forget what Dr. Desnard said. He says, "I've never seen a man have a strong enough erection to hold up a relationship."
That's amazing.
It takes more than that. That isn't being a provider in its entirety. In part, sure, right? But yeah, I remember being young, like an impressionable kid, like influenced by the, sort of almost sort of religious nonsense about sexuality, right? I mean, in my growing up, there were the European families where the adults wandered around naked in front of their kids, and then there was the TV depiction of American life with husband and wife in twin beds and pajamas from the neck down to the ankles, right? Like the Dick Van Dyke Show, right? He and Mary Tyler Moore had separate beds, right? Like what's going on here? But here's what I remember, right? You're trying to discover yourself when you're young. I was bi curious and homophobic, right? Like I could read a room, and if I was in a room where it was like a toxic machismo, right? I could just I had the jokes, I had the agreement, I would sort of enable all of that. But I didn't know who I was, right? But I was also very sort of sensitive to, people who, same sex, I could see that that was a natural thing, that although the society might frown upon it, I felt like I had to be, all of those male imposed things. I had to be a good provider. I had to be, I definitely was preoccupied with sex. I think our society, had the opposite effect on trying to deter people, and no mentors around that, parents or, education in school was about, the male orgasm. That was sex education, right? Because that's, you didn't need a female orgasm for child, for procreation, right? Like all we learned about was this penetration in a very clinical sense, and how you had to avoid that because of the problems it would cause you in your future if you, fooled around like that as a teenager. Like it was just this mixed up world of messages for sure.
Probably to me, there's been a lot of people that have dug into this area as sex therapists, right? Masters and Johnson were
Yes.
the people that really started to open up this area and start to help people. And look, it was, what happened in the field of psychotherapy was the same thing. Nobody was talking about this stuff either. I mean, so,
Yeah.
when Masters Johnson had couples come in and had sex and they were observing them and stuff, they was like, what? What are you doing? It's like this
Yeah.
stuff that was forbidden turf, right? This was taboo, that kind of a thing.
It
So
seemed
it opened
obscene.
up. Yeah, well, and I think that was like in the 70s, that Masters and Johnson's, maybe late 60s. I'll
Late
have to.
60s, maybe. Joy of Sex came out like before 1970, I think. And here's credit to my parents. They owned it and they left it in the living room. They didn't hide it away.
The sex book that my parents left for me to, not for me to look at, but that I did look at was Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. That's a good one.
Right, yeah.
1972, Joe.
Okay, 72. Okay.
That's about
Yeah.
the time that, I was starting to go to school and they were starting to talk about this, and they had human sexuality classes and stuff like that. And so it started getting opened up. But here was an interesting observation that Dr. David Snarch made. He started to talk about differentiation and applying it to sex therapy. Now, remember, differentiation, as we've talked about it, is related to emotional sobriety. The more mature we are, the more differentiated we are. The more emotionally mature we are, the more differentiated we're. The more emotionally dependent we are, the more undifferentiated our self is. The more differentiated self I have, the healthier I'm going to be. The more I'm going to be able to, the better functioning I'm going to have as a person. What he did is he was very good at showing us the impact of an undifferentiated self on sex. And when you hear it, it's going to be so parallel what we talk about in recovery, because when I'm undifferentiated and I'm in the bedroom, because remember, the bedroom opens off, the door opens off the living room, I'm undifferentiated in my life. So I come in the bedroom. So now, because I have other validated self-esteem, now I'm not in the bedroom to enjoy sex. I'm in the bedroom to get a grade. I want you
Yeah.
to score my performance. How many men, after they're done making love to a woman, says, "How was that for you?"
Oh yeah, I used to ask for grades regularly, which
Oh
was
my
so
God.
stupid. Yeah.
Well, it's not stupid. It's It reflects our consciousness. See, I think we got to
Yeah.
keep
And
thinking
our
about,
programming.
oh my God, yes. And it does. And so, and women for the same thing. I mean, you know, how they're experiencing their body and whether they're desirable or not, they're doing the same thing. You know, am I acceptable? Am I going to please him? Is he going to like my body? Am I attractive enough? So when you bring that energy into the bedroom, what happens to the sexual, to what's natural is our sexual response. We know that that's just, you know, it's neurologically wired into us, right? It gets messed up big time because instead of paying attention to the sensations and our experience, we're doing what Masters and Johnson called spectatoring. Do you remember that term, Joe?
Spectatoring.
We
Yeah.
are sitting in the bleachers next to the bed and we're watching our performance.
I remember it, like you couldn't ask questions. You'd be for fear of being laughed at, you know, an unfounded fear, but you know, like I'm supposed to know before I've done anything, right? Like I'm supposed to be an expert at 14 years old. I thought when I was 14, I thought I was the only kid in school who hadn't had intercourse yet because I didn't know everyone else was lying. And this expectation was like it wasn't a pleasure to have sex, it was a relief.
That distinction between pleasure and relief. No, I love that. I've found that the bedroom opens off the living room, and where I feel like I've been able to experience the most genuine intimacy has been in my monogamous relationships. And my most toxic time, I feel like, for my sexuality was definitely towards the end of my using, which should come as no surprise, because I was just going to a lot of bars, and I was going home to a lot with a lot of people from bars, and I was I'd been broken up with like a couple of years before I got sober, and I was trying to settle a score, you know. So I was just trying to get you know, just to sleep with as many people as possible to feel less to feel more worthy, I suppose. And then that mixed with, you know, my drugs and alcohol were like really self-destructive. But I remember my first like sexual relationship after my sobriety date. It was a very like brief fling with somebody I met in the rooms. But it was very sweet, you know, like I think that we were both you know, I hear that term trauma bonding thrown around a lot, you know. So maybe this would qualify, but there was just something of you know, we were clear, or as clear as we had been for quite some time, and we were really seeing each other, and we were just loving on each other. And you know, as I you know, every year and every new relationship, I seem to encounter new successes and new problems as far as bonding with somebody sexually. And what you say about the differentiation, Alan, I think is really important because this also goes into like consent, you know, because when we're differentiated from somebody, we can you know, we can give that contact, that touch to somebody freely. You know what I mean? It really is a kind of a freely given and a freely taken thing. And that's like a cornerstone of intimacy, right?
You know, you've heard this said, and we throw it out. That's why that idea that, you know, the door to the bedroom opens off the living room is so apropos. You know, you can't say yes until you can say no. See, that's the consent part of this thing. If there's not room for me to say no, I don't want to do this. No, I don't like this. This is what I would rather have. I want this. See, back to talking about a healthy person is a person that operates based on staying grounded in what their experience is and what their desire is, which that's, you know, you've heard me say this before. When you're an adult, what are the two reasons to do something? Because you want to or don't, period. I mean, that's it. you want to or don't. People go, what? No, that can't be. You've got to do things you don't like. No, you don't. You don't really have to do that. I don't do things I don't like in my life anymore. I don't. I drive a lot of people crazy with that idea because they think life is about doing the things you don't want to do. That's a sucky life. I mean, my God, I want to get up and do all the things I don't want to do today. That's fun. I mean, come on. What are we doing to ourselves? But take that into the bedroom. Are you able to, as a man or even as a woman, to say, no, I don't want that. I don't want to be touched like that. I don't like that. How open can you be in terms of what your desire is? And how open can you be to hearing what your partner's desire is? So that's the thing. But now that brings in all of these issues. The more undifferentiated I am, the more anxiety I'm going to bring into the bedroom. And I'm also going to evaluate or judge how much you care about me by whether or not you're having sex with me. You've heard it said before, women need to feel loved to have sex, and men need to have sex to feel loved. I mean, people talk about that as a gender difference. I don't think it's 100% true, but it's true more than it's not. It's definitely true more than it's not. So, look, we're just starting to open this up. And I'm so glad you brought the consent thing into it because the higher your level of emotional maturity and differentiation, the more room there is for somebody else. And you don't want to take somebody from something that they don't want to give you.
Yeah, I mean, I was so like touched by when we would explore this in our workshops about like a crucial aspect of emotional sobriety is that it enables you to actually see the other person and to actually because your relationship with another person isn't just like contingent on all the things that they do for us, or the ways that they validate us or flatter us. You know what I mean? Like it actually opens the door for like a real connection. You know what I mean? Because all that we do and all the time and the attention we lavish on the other person is it's given freely. It's not just
Real intimacy, you've heard that people play on words, into me you see. That meaning that real intimacy is to really be able to see the other person as they are, not as an object of our desire, but as a subject that we're sharing desire with. See, there's a big difference in terms of that.
Yeah.
And that's why, for me, I got first introduced to sexuality and stuff through Playboy. I mean, it was Playboy and Penthouse magazines, and masturbation. I remember hiding the play. We had those false ceilings, those drop down ceilings with those little tiles that you can push up. I hid my Playboys up in
Oh,
there
yeah.
because my mom was too smart of looking in between my bed to see if I had any.
There's a stand-up comedian, Jim Jefferies, and he talks about how he would ride his bicycle to a tree where he hid the porn magazines, like under some leaves, and there would be like, the jack-off clearing, where he would ride his bike. And I thought that was very funny. Relatable,
Yeah, so you're right, man. And the more intimate, intimacy is directly related to differentiation. The more differentiated I am, the more I can have a healthy connection to someone. The more undifferentiated I am, the more I bring my dependency into the scene. And that creates a whole big thing.
Without that sort of understanding that I'm one of two, the inclination is to objectify, right? Again, this is my test. This is my opportunity to be validated. I mean, none of that is intimate, right? It's almost it's more competitive than it is collaborative. And to have two people who have a healthy amount of emotional sobriety or differentiation, what a they, a he her, a he, a her, It's a collaboration, and it doesn't, our pasts are very a very little value, right? Because you know what my experience was with my last intimate lover might shed some light on what I like, but it's not gonna, you know, be help me inform discovering this relationship with this new partner, right? That's we're always, you know, discovering. We always have to bring curiosity as opposed to the pressures of, you know, filling some sort of programmed, you know, gender identification role that, you know, we want to fit into to meet somebody else's approval. Ugh, it just turns my stomach just to think about it in those terms.
Joe, you can see the evolution of this in terms of, let's just look at the female orgasm, right? That there was this whole big movement starting in the 70s, you know, to help women experience orgasm. And what that was leading to was each person being responsible for their experience in the bedroom. See, before someone would take the responsibility, like I'm responsible for my partner to get her off. If I get her off, then I'm a good lover. Right? And you know what I see in the new generation of people, I think one of the things there is an evolution going on is that now people are taking more of their individual responsibility, you know, and if a woman wants something and to be touched a certain way, or during sex, she'll be touching herself a certain way and getting off and enjoying it. And that's what this is about, is being free to enjoy ourselves and our partner. See, that's where the freedom comes in, that is so important. If you can be free in the bedroom, you can be spontaneous. You can have fun. You can laugh. You can experiment. You can play around.
Yeah, I mean, I'm learning things from both ends of the spectrum of, you know, being with the partner, having a lot of sex, and, you know, what does that mean? Or like, what does that, you know, how are we communicating through that? And then being with a partner and having none or very little sex, and, you know, maintaining an intimacy and a communication through that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say, except like, I feel like, I'm always a student. I never feel really settled in my sex life. There's worlds to explore.
I think of people like raising kids today and helping prepare them. I read that most children by the age of 11 have seen hardcore pornographic sex. And, you know, does that educate or does that desensitize? Does that further create objectification, or you know, like just the progression of, you know, the degree of access to sort of pornographic images. I mean, pinups to hardcore porn, there's a big shift, you know. One leaves at least more to the imagination, but like it's a whole new world, and I find I'm reading more and more, you know, Generation Z aren't hooking up in the same way, you know, boomers, Gen X did.
I've heard the same, yeah.
There's something going on, and I don't pretend to understand it, but you know, I'm very curious, like what's going on for young people today.
We talked about the Playboys and growing up with that, but like you know, I think a lot of the messages, the narratives that are transmitted through, you know, porn can kind of like lead people into some strange directions, or you know, I mean, it's yeah, it's a double-edged sword because maybe there's an educational aspect to it, but also desensitization, and how much is it supplanting, you know, like the fundamental human connection, you know, that like lies underneath, you know, our sexuality.
Yeah, and you know, body image and all those things that affect, teenagers, right?
Well, look, I'm glad we're starting to open up this issue for discussion. And let's follow this up and have a couple more shows on this, Patrick, because I think it's so important to talk
Yeah,
about,
because it I
what is emotional
like
sobriety?
I'm
What's
a
up?
big believer you need to sort of bring emotional sobriety into every area of life, right? And for me, it is hard to unglue myself from, programming, and just, start anew without everything I was taught that was helpful, everything I was taught that was not helpful, a lifetime of experiences bringing them, it requires being very mindful about these things and like not shutting down, right? It requires talking and connection and like a positive expectation. It's also easy to go, oh, not again. How's this going to end, right? Like there's all kinds of, noise, the signal to noise ratio in terms of what's useful. And if we can bring something useful to this, it's, these outside issues that, just to make a caricature of the sponsee is talking to the sponsor about, sex, money, that's, like those are things we're what not supposed to talk about. Those are things where we our work, our relationships, our need for intimacy, all of those things require, like an emotional sobriety approach to them if you're going to grow.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. So when we started on this journey, Alan, and you taught me about emotional sobriety, you impressed upon me that, you're going to be able to do it all. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to be able to find the career, that works best for you. The artistic pursuit, the family relationships can be strengthened, and the sexual, desire and the romantic relationships. It's like emotional sobriety builds capacity. I think we should definitely do more episodes and bring additional voices in, including Tom. Let's bat him around a little bit in this and see what he says.
Sounds like a good idea. And you're going to be on a quite an adventure, Patrick.
Yes. Hopefully I'll have some sex on it.
Not with the camel.
No. I mean, unless, hey, if the camel consents, who knows?
You're
That'll be part three of our series. Thank you, Joe.
peace.